You're right, she said finally. I hadn't thought about it that way. Not yet, anyway. Of course, she drew a deep breath and pitched her voice with a careful, deliberate seasoning of mockery and affection. I imagine I'd have gotten around to it by the time I'm as old and decrepit as you are. Merlin laughed, and she smiled as she heard it. Whippersnapper, he said after a second or two. Just remember, Pika's strengths are proportionate to their size, and I'm a foot taller than you are. Fortunately, you're also a bigger target. Sort of like Bronzelik, she added, pulling the conversation back to her original topic. Well, he replied, accepting the change of topic, since it's a tad difficult to hide 70,000 men, 25 or 30,000 horses, and several hundred draft dragons and wagons when people are looking for them, I figured the least we could do was to help Alvarez figure out where to look. I thought it was only neighborly of us. You are a bad, bad man. The severity of her tone was somewhat undermined by what sounded suspiciously like a giggle, and Merlin smiled. Sir Reynos Alvarez had demonstrated that there was precious little hope of completely surprising him. Even with Kurbish feeding the army of Shiloh false information, he'd been cautious enough to establish that cavalry screen of his in the first place. But he also knew how vital his Bronzelik supply center had become, and the moment he decided his enemies seriously intended to destroy it, he'd do everything in his power to protect it. Just as young Captain Prescott had displayed both intelligence and initiative in riding to buttress Bronzelik's defense, Alvarez would send everything he could to do the same thing. And the more of his cavalry he sent to Bronzelik, the thinner his screen between Highmount and Roymark would become. It probably wasn't going to work out as well as Eastshire's audacity deserved, but the odds said it would still work as well as they needed it to. And that would just have to be good enough. As Commodore Pei used to say, he reflected, wondering if Nemu was remembering the same thing at that moment, surprise is what happens when you find out that something you saw all along isn't what you thought it was. And that, General Alvarez, is a lesson I'm looking forward to sharing with you. Chapter 3. Royal Palace, City of Monchir, Princedom of Coruscant, and Carizian Embassy, Sidar City, Republic of Sidarmark.
That's right, Your Highness. A little higher. You want the boar as close to in line with your hand as you can get it, but make sure your grip's comfortable, too. It's important for it to sit properly in your hand. Remember, you want a little muzzle rise when you're firing single shot. It'll get your thumb back onto the hammer spur quicker, but as little as you can manage when you're firing double action, because that lets you stay on target better for follow-up shots. These grips are a pretty good compromise between single and double action, but my hands are a little larger than yours, and they were individually modified for me. Once we get Master Malden an impression of your hands, he'll probably spend hours in the pistol shop, happy as a wyvern watching a rabbit hole and whistling the whole time he personally customizes and tunes one of his new babies especially for you. Her Majesty's is on its way to her in Chisholm right now. Of course, she's on her way here, so she'll probably want to play with mine, too, until her own catches up.
Iris Aplin Armok concentrated on her instructor's soothing words. They sounded a bit odd through the ear protection the instructor insisted she wear whenever they visited the range, whether or not they were actively shooting. But they were clear enough, and she soaked them up with what had begun as grim determination, only to turn into genuine enthusiasm as she sat through the preliminary classroom instruction and discovered how much she enjoyed the teaching. Unlike Empress Charlian, Iris had never been trained with firearms before she was sent off to Delphirock, and King James would never have dreamed of allowing her to handle them after he'd agreed to provide her and Divan with sanctuary from their enemies. He would have considered it entirely unladylike, and he would have had a pretty good idea of how the Inquisition might have felt about it, too. That hadn't really bothered her, then. But that had been before the Cathedral Square bomb attack, before her husband had been mortally wounded on their wedding day and pulled back from the threshold of death only by the grace of God and a wonder greater than she could ever have imagined. Before her entire universe had been changed forever, and she'd discovered her own blazing determination to shatter the chains of deceit which enslaved her entire species. Before she'd decided that anyone, anywhere, man, woman, or demon, whoever again wanted to harm someone she loved, would have to go through her first. "That's good," the red-haired woman known as Nimu Twerio said approvingly from beside her, standing well clear as she used both hands to gently and minutely adjust Iris's grip on the revolver's checkered teakwood grip panels. "Now, weak hand under strong hand, and pull back. That's right. Push forward with strong hand. Counter tension. Good. Now hold it steady." Captain Twerio checked the placement of her feet, then pushed gently on the underside of the barrel, testing the pistol's steadiness as she stood in what Nimu had called the weaver stance before they headed for the range. "That's very good," she said. "Now hammer back." The ball of Iris's thumb moved to the hammer spur, pulling until it clicked solidly into the cocked position. It moved with glassy smoothness, but the muzzle still wavered ever so slightly. "Have to do better next time," she thought, settling her thumb back into the contoured groove at the top of the grip panel. "Index finger on the trigger. Remember how I showed you to place it?" The pad of her finger rested on the smooth face of the trigger just before the first joint. "All right, this time we're bullseye shooting. We'll worry about combat shooting later. So take the time to find both sights and tell me when you've got them." "Now," Iris murmured after a moment, both eyes open, front blade resting quiet and solid in the notch of the rear sight and aligned on the target. The target and front sight were clear, the rear slightly blurred as she concentrated on the sight picture the way Captain Twerio had taught her. "Then remember there's no trigger slack firing single action, and then it's time to squeeze." Iris obeyed, squeezing gently, steadily, so as to leave her hand's position undisturbed, balanced, unmoving. The hammer fell with a crisp, swift sureness, sudden as a breaking rod of glass, that made her twitch in surprise, even though she'd been expecting it.
"Exactly," her instructor congratulated her. "Done properly, you should always be surprised by the exact moment the trigger breaks. Try it single shot a few more times, then we'll try double action. And after you've done that a dozen times or so," she smiled broadly, "we'll load live rounds instead of practice cases, and you can actually make some holes in a target."
Lieutenant Charles Shelton was in a foul mood. He felt his jaw muscles clench as he strode along, conscientiously attempting to put Major Myers' advice into practice. It would have been easier if Myers hadn't had his own head so far up his arse he needed a glass belly button to see where he was going. Technically, the Coruscantian Royal Guard reported to Sir Corin Garvai in his capacity as the Regency Council's deputy, but Garvai's actual experience with the Guard's duties and responsibilities was limited at best, in Shelton's view, and it damned well showed. Major Timon Mayers, the Guard's senior officer, should have reported to Prince Divan. Since that was impossible in light of Divan's age, Garvai had to do instead. Except, of course, that Garvai was a frigging idiot. And much as Shelton had always respected Mayers in the past, it was obvious the Major had turned into just as big an idiot. Shelton paused in the shade of an ornamental persimmon fig tree, trying to relax his jaw, and closed his eyes as that vast sense of wrongness flowed over him once more. The Guard had never been huge, and Prince Hector had actually reduced it in size. He'd wanted it small, small enough to reinforce its awareness of its elite nature and status, small enough he could know every one of his guardsmen personally, If a larger security force was required for a specific occasion, it was recruited from one of the household regiments, but organized, coordinated, and commanded by the guard. And because the guard was too small to be burdened with heaps of captains and majors and colonels, but still had to command that additional troop strength when necessary, Prince Hector had ordained that any guardsman was two ranks senior to anyone of his own nominal rank in the Royal Coruscantian Army or Navy. That meant Major Myers was actually equal in rank to General Garvey, and that Lieutenant Shelton was equal in rank to an Army major, and that was as it should be. As it had to be, if the guard was going to do its job properly. But doing its job properly meant Myers should have reminded Garvey of the equivalence of their ranks and refused to accept the insane orders he'd seen fit to issue. At the very least, the major should have demanded written confirmation from the Regency Council as a whole. The lieutenant's teeth were grinding again, and he clasped his hands behind him, hands curled into fists, while he pretended to study the brilliant flowers spilling over the mortared stone wall of the persimmon fig's tree well. If the Regency Council wanted to assert its right to oversee the guard, surely it should have understood Prince Divan had to be protected by men trained and accustomed to that duty, men who'd served his father in the same role, who demonstrated their loyalty, understood the danger signs to look for, had the training and experience, the education to do the job properly. But no, not the Regency Council, and not General Garvey. Of course the boy wanted familiar faces around him. How could it be any other way? Given how his life had been shaken up three ways from Wednesday, it was inevitable that he'd want people he knew about him, and no child his age was fit to judge an armsman's actual competence, or lack of it. Shelton understood that, and he would have been delighted to find places in the guard for the common armsman who looked after him in his exile, places where they could be properly evaluated and trained, or eased into some other honorable task if, in the end, they proved unfitted for guard duty. But what could the Regency Council have been thinking to promote someone like Tobias Raymer to commissioned rank? And what madness could have seen Lieutenant Raymer assigned as Prince Divan's personal armsman? And then, not content with promoting a man who'd spent 30 years in the army without ever rising above the level of sergeant to the equivalent of an army major, they'd staffed the prince's personal detachment exclusively with newcomers to the guard who'd never been vetted properly and whose only claim to their positions was that they, too, had been with the prince in Delphirac, where Earl Corus, professional spy and treason broker, had hired them because he couldn't find anyone better.
"Damn it," Shelton thought. "Damn it to hell. They've got no business leaving the boy security in hands like that. Hands chosen by that bastard Corus."
He felt the rage quivering through his shoulders. Everyone knew what a conniver, what a schemer Philip Osgood was. Shelton had never understood why someone as smart as Prince Hector had chosen someone like that to safeguard his daughter and younger son in a foreign land. And whatever anyone else might say, Charles Shelton remained far from convinced by all this evidence about who'd actually ordered Prince Hector's assassination. He didn't doubt Iris and Divan believed it. What else could you expect from a girl child and a boy barely turned 10? When the guardian they'd been told to trust warned them Mother Church wanted them dead. That didn't necessarily make it true, especially when the only proof anyone had was Corus's own word and the testimony of a man who claimed, admitted, he'd betrayed Mother Church's own Inquisition for decades before she went to war against heresy. Shelton could hardly believe, even now, that the Royal Council had chosen not simply to take a spymaster's word for that, but then to put him and a girl barely 20 years old on Prince Divan's Regency Council, and made his sister his official guardian into the bargain. Couldn't they at least have found someone with a modicum of maturity instead of an empty-headed girl who was obviously thinking with her heart and other body parts instead of her brain? Someone who understood the need to hold those murderous Carisian heretics at arm's length instead of literally jumping into bed with them? Hell and damnation. If the Council was going to be that stupid, why not go the full distance and put that foreign-born bastard of a duke on the Regency Council, too? No doubt he was already doing plenty of whispering into Iris's ear while he diddled her. And, of course, putting Raymer in command of the boy's detail had bounced everyone else out of their rightful assignments. By seniority and experience, Lieutenant Hiram Bonisteer should be Diven's personal armsman, and Shelton should command Iris's permanent detachment. He could have stomached that. He'd known Bonisteer for over 15 years, knew he was a solid, loyal officer. He might be a bit too warm towards the reformists for Shelton's taste, but he sure as Shan Wei hadn't been recommended by a spy or insisted upon by a doting little boy or a girl besotted by the common-born gigolo she'd taken to her bed. The one good thing was that, unlike Bonisteer, Shelton didn't have to smile at His Grace of Darkos and pretend he trusted the son of a bitch. Of course, it was terrible that some misguided soul had killed so many bystanders, and it would have been a tragedy to lose Princess Iris. But at least it might have gotten that shellhorn out of the heart of the palace and away from Prince Diven before he stung someone to death. And then the final blow. A Carisian officially inserted into Prince Diven's own household without invitation, without consultation, without anyone even knowing about it ahead of time. Emperor Caleb had given all of Coruscant the back of his hand with that one, especially when he dispatched his personal agent long before he could have known the princedom would decide to bend its neck to the yoke. Obviously, it hadn't mattered to him what the Royal Council and Parliament might have ultimately decided. He'd wanted his spy, his eyes and ears, probably his assassin at need, inside Diven's household, where not even the guard could protect him. And it wasn't even an armsman. It was an armswoman. Shelton gagged on the thought. Women were all very well in their place, and someone with his height, looks, and position was more successful with them than most. But prancing around in armor, pretending she knew what to do with that sword she carried or that fancy new revolver of hers? Daring to look at real armsmen, men who'd spent years learning their skills, earning that title, instead of having someone simply hand it to them because they were pretty or good on their backs, with those cool, dismissive blue eyes? And claiming captain's rank. Captain's rank that made her senior to a Coruscantian royal guardsman. Well, the bitch is just likely she's not actually assigned to the guard, he thought hotly. She spins a good tale about being here as Caleb and Charlian's representative, about how they don't want her interfering. What it really does is save her from having to prove how good she really is, or isn't, as an armsman. That's what it does. She gets to sit around ingratiating herself even further with Iris and Diven without ever betraying the fact that she doesn't know shit about an armsman's real duties. Shan Wei, she's even offered to teach Iris how to shoot. He snorted contemptuously. He'd seen her sitting on the east patio that morning as he passed by on his way to his counseling session with Major Myers. She'd had that newfangled, and probably prescribed, whatever that so-called intendant might say back in Karras, revolver of hers on the table between her and Iris, showing the princess the damned thing's parts one at a time and explaining them. Even if she'd actually known how the thing's innards worked, which Shelton doubted, what possible need was there for Iris to learn it? It wasn't as if she'd ever use a weapon in her own defense. She was a woman, for Langhorne's sake. All part of that act of hers, he grumbled. Impressive as hell to a girl or a kid as young as Diven, but it's a hell of a lot easier to describe a double play than to actually execute one. Worst thing that could possibly happen for Iris or that husband of hers would be for someone to come at them and not have anyone but Captain Twerio between them and a dagger. And as for that Sajin dragon shit, oh, please, just how stupid does Caleb think we are? He squeezed his eyes shut for a long, smoldering moment, then forced himself to exhale deeply. He'd only worry himself into an apoplectic seizure if he kept dwelling on it this way. All he and any of the real guardsmen could do was redouble their watchfulness to take up the slack for people like Raymer, keep an eye on Duke Darkos and the rest of the pro-Karis bootlickers, and wait for the opportunity to prove that, whatever else she might be, Nimu Twirio was no Sajin sent by the Archangels to preserve Prince Divan and Princess Iris from the sinister, evil assassins of Mother Church. He told himself that firmly, nodded once, and resumed his progress towards the armory. It was more important than ever to perform his own duties efficiently if he wanted to demonstrate by comparison how poorly Lieutenant Raymer performed his. Besides, it wouldn't be long until lunch, and gunfire exploded somewhere ahead of him. For an instant, he froze, his right hand dropping to the double-barreled pistol at his side. Then he realized it had come from the pistol range General Garvey had insisted the guard construct inside the palace walls, and he relaxed a bit, only to stiffen once more as the gunshots continued to crack out, one after another. There were six of them, a slow, rolling thunder, timed as if by a musician's metronome, and Shelton's mouth tightened. Those reports could have come from only one weapon, and he altered course. "Clear your weapon," Nimu commanded from her position behind Iris, and the princess obediently raised the muzzle, ejected the spent cartridge cases, and then laid the pistol, cylinder still out, on the shooting bench.
"We really have to get the target carrier system Master Malden came up with installed here," Nimu said. "In the meantime, let's hike down and see how well you did." "I already know how well I did," Iris replied, unable to keep a slight note of pride out of her tone. 47 out of a possible 60.
She grimaced, her pride deflating somewhat as she thought about the one flyer, her first shot, which had missed the target completely at a range of little more than 25 feet. 3 of the other 5 had been in the 10 ring, however, and 2 of them had been in the X-ring itself.
"I already know that, too," Nimu said, in that voice which sounded nothing at all like Merlin Athrawus's, and yet carried that elusive hint of similarity. "However, I know that because I have telescopic vision, and you know that because you've got those nifty contact lenses. But there are at least a dozen people unobtrusively watching your lesson from various windows. Don't you think they might find it a little strange that you and I didn't have to go down and, I don't know, examine your target?"
"Oh." Iris felt her cheekbones heat, then laughed and shook her head at the exotically attractive red-haired woman at her elbow.
"Sorry. I guess I'm still in what Hector calls the kid's new toy phase. Sometimes I find myself actually starting to take it all for granted, and then something pulls me back to reality, and I have to sit down, hard, while I try to cope with all the things that can't possibly be true." "Not surprising, I'd say," Nimu replied, twitching her head in the direction of Iris's target and then following the princess down the firing line. "It came at you awfully fast, Your Highness. And I'd imagine watching your husband dying on your wedding day didn't do anything to reduce the stress factor. Toss in the minor consideration that it contradicts everything you've ever been taught about God and the universe, and we could probably give you another, couple of 5 days to adjust. In fact, I'm feeling generous. You can have to the end of next month."
Iris laughed again, harder. She also shook her head.
"That is generous of you. I'm afraid it's likely to take me a little longer, though. And speaking about adjusting, you seem awfully calm about all this, especially considering that you're, less than a month old,"
Nimu supplied.
"Something like that, I suppose."
They reached the target and stood there, redhead and dark, bent to examine the holes punched through the printed paper, and Iris glanced up at Namu's serene expression.
"It's hard for me to realize, really realize, I mean, that you didn't even exist 2 months ago. And it's even harder for me to realize you and Sage and Merlin are the same person.
It's been a minor adjustment for me, too. Of course, we're not really the same person anymore. I've come to think of him more as an older brother I know really, really well. Trust me, it's simpler that way. Less likely to cause my brain to explode, too.
Would it really? Explode, I mean.
Iris's eyes widened, and Nemu sighed.
It was a figure of speech, Your Highness.
I doubt a Pika could explode, given that the Federation didn't much like the idea of allowing vest-pocket nuclear bombs to walk around its city streets. It took a fairly dim view of that, actually, now that I think about it. Can't imagine why.
Oh,
Iris said again, a bit sheepishly.
I should have thought of that, but I haven't had much time to spend with Owl's explanations of how all this technology of yours works. The only times Hector and I can be sure we're really alone is in our own apartment with you outside the door and, well...
And a pair of newlyweds with privacy and time on their hands have better things to do than talk to an artificial intelligence in a cave halfway around the world, Nemu suggested helpfully.
Well, yes.
Iris seemed very fascinated by the punctured target for a few moments, then grinned and looked at Nemu once more.
We lost all that time right after the wedding, you understand?
Then by all means, make up for it now, the red-haired Seijin told her. And since the two of you have to spend so much time lying low to keep anyone from figuring out how rapidly Hector's convalescence is speeding along, anything that keeps you out of sight, out of mind, is probably worthwhile in its own right.
Especially since we can't even talk to Philip about it,
Iris agreed.
He's being very thoughtful about leaving the two of us time to be together.
It's an extra complication, Nemu conceded. Still, once the Brethren recover from the shock of finding out you and Hector know the truth, I doubt they'll take all that long to decide Earl Corus ought to be initiated to the Inner Circle as well. Especially since Diven really is too young to be burdened with something like this. You and Hector need at least one other person the Regency Council trusts.
Exactly.
Iris took down the target and folded it under her arm while she watched Nemu tack up a replacement. After a moment, the princess shook her head.
You know, I think it's conversations like this that make it so difficult for me to realize how, well, new you are, Nemu. You're really not a lot like Sage and Merlin. I don't mean that just physically. You have very different personalities, too. Yet you seem just as familiar with all of the power relationship and diplomacy and military operations as he does.
We do have different personalities. Nemu's words came a bit more slowly, and she seemed very focused on her hands as she finished tacking the target in place and smoothed it with one palm.
Merlin has a lot more mileage, I suppose, on his personality. Nemu Alban was only about 27 when she recorded me. That's only about 9 Safeholdian years older than you are now. And Merlin's 7 local years older than that. 7 hard years. I haven't had to go through all of that. Not yet, anyway. And I haven't seen as many people I care for die as he has.
But you saw the entire Federation die,
Iris said softly.
Yes, I did. Oh, I missed the final battle, but I knew what was going to happen, and I watched a lot of people die before Operation Ark. But I knew all those people were going to die anyway, Iris.
She looked across at the princess, the late morning breeze toying with a few strands of red silk which had escaped her braid.
They were doomed. No matter what happened, I couldn't change that. They couldn't change that. No one could. You didn't let yourself care too deeply in that situation. And if you did, you pretended you didn't, even to yourself. But Merlin and I have been given the opportunity to change that. People like Caleb and Charlian, like Michael, like you and Hector, don't have to die. And that terrifies me, really. Because even if you don't have to, you still can. And now I have to learn, the same way Merlin did, how much that hurts.
Iris's hazel eyes softened, and she laid one hand on Nemu's mailed forearm. She started to say something, then thought better of it, and only shook her head, and Nemu turned both of them back towards the shooting bench.
As for how familiar I am with those power relationships, I'm not really as new as you might think.
She smiled slightly.
I'm the improved, compact-sized Pika, you understand. My brain's not hardwired to dump its contents every 10 days, so nobody had to fool around with my basic software. And unlike Merlin, my high-speed port works just fine. That means I can interface directly with Prince Narman's VR and OWL in compressed time. I actually spent several subjective months studying all the data Merlin, Narman, and OWL had selected for me, and acquiring Merlin's physical skills.
She chuckled.
It was considerate of him to upload all that muscle memory, but our centers of balance, reach, and leverage are just a bit different. It wouldn't have done much for my own Seijin's reputation if I'd found myself in a sword fight and started dancing around as if I had a foot more reach than I do. I hadn't thought about that either,
Iris said with a chuckle.
Even if it had occurred to me, I probably wouldn't... Oh, crap.
Nemu snorted. She'd already noticed the approaching guardsman, and she was no better pleased to see him than Iris. On the other hand, in many ways, it might actually be harder for Iris than it was for her. To her, Charles Shelton was simply a benighted bigot, someone too set in his attitudes to ever realize just how stupid they were. She'd discovered that it helped to remember that the Royal Guard, of which he was so proud, was smaller than a single company of Federation Marines, and had perhaps, being generous, 1/10,000th of the Marines' combat power. And that the Federation's military by the time of Operation Ark had boasted a strength of over 2.7 billion active duty human beings, 90% of them combat personnel, and approximately half of them female human beings. A quarter of whom were Marines who probably could have broken the bastard up into individual servings of dog food with their bare hands, she reflected now, watching him stride arrogantly towards them. Unlike her, Iris had known Shelton almost since the day she'd learned to walk. Once upon a time, to a little girl, he'd probably been just as much of a demigod as he clearly thought he still was. And where Nemu was an outsider, Iris was still the little girl who could be patted, respectfully, of course, on top of the head and ignored. And if anything had been needed to justify that estimate of her character, the fact that she'd married a foreigner 3 years younger than she was, and who'd been born a commoner, clearly supplied it.
"Why don't you reload, Your Highness?"
Nemu said, moving casually between her and the source of her ire.
"Leave the cylinder open until we're ready to begin again." "Of course, Captain Chuerio,"
Iris replied in a clear, carrying voice that emphasized Nemu's rank with malice aforethought. Nemu managed not to roll her eyes before she turned to face Shelton. She couldn't really blame Iris, but satisfying as the flicker of anger the princess had put into Shelton's eyes might be, it wasn't likely to help the situation any. She faced the lieutenant fully and inclined her head in greeting.
"Good morning, Lieutenant," she said.
Shelton swallowed an urge to rip the trollop's head off. Lieutenant, indeed. She was always so careful to use his rank rather than address him as Sir. "Captain," he replied, the word an epithet cloaked in a veneer of courtesy, emphasized just enough to remind her that his rank was effectively that of Major.
"How may I help you this morning?"
she asked, apparently oblivious to his tone. He considered several satisfying answers to that inquiry, but, alas, none of them were permissible in front of a witness, especially not one named Princess Iris. "I heard gunfire," he said instead. Neither Chuerio nor Princess Iris replied. The princess continued reloading the revolver with the air of someone taking her time about it, and Chuerio only regarded him calmly, as if waiting for him to say something worth commenting upon. "I was unaware anyone had signed in for range time this morning," he continued after a moment, hearing a harder, sharper edge in his own voice.
"I personally informed Major Myers that Captain Twerio would be instructing me, Lieutenant."
Princess Iris's voice was cool as she entered the conversation for the first time.
"That's very interesting, Your Highness."
Shelton never took his eyes from Twerio's face.
"I, however, am the officer of the day, not Major Myers. If the range is to be used and safety regulations are to be met, the officer of the day, me, in other words, is supposed to be informed by the senior member of the guard using the range."
He simply couldn't bring himself to use the term guardsman in connection with the woman in front of him.
"When he takes responsibility for safety on the firing line. I don't recall seeing your requisition for range time this morning, Captain."
"Forgive me, Lieutenant, but that isn't precisely correct," Twerio said in that oh-so-superior tone of hers. "Regulations require anyone who wants to use the range to inform the designated range officer, which is the officer of the day under normal circumstances. However, as the officer of the day, you'd signed off to the armory sergeant of the day, I believe because you were scheduled to meet with Major Myers."
Her expression was perfectly grave, but he felt her smirking at him from behind those bland blue eyes.
"When Princess Iris and I completed our weapons familiarization, I went to the armory to check the availability of the range and signed in as range officer with Sergeant Jodwell."
She held up the token which had to be signed out whenever the range was in use and returned to the armory at the end of every firing session. Shelton felt his face darken. Of course it had been Trevor Jodwell, another of those Delphirakin old hands who'd been foisted on the guard. And even though it was customary to reserve range time the day before, Twerio was just the sort of barracks lawmaster to point out that the regulations didn't require that. In fact, he was pretty damn sure she'd waited until she knew he was with Myers before signing in with Jodwell. Probably because she'd realized he'd have insisted a proper guardsman take charge of Iris's training if any live rounds were to be fired. And he would have, too, by Chihiro, and the hell with all that dragon shit about her being attached to the guard.
"And now, if you'll excuse us, Lieutenant," she said, "I have to ask you to step back behind the safety line and cover your ears, since you don't appear to have brought plugs with you."
She turned away, clasping her hands at the small of her back and standing in an instructor's posture as she took up the proper range officer's position behind and to Princess Iris's right.
"Live rounds on the range," she announced loudly. "Ready on the right, ready on the left."
"Your Highness, you may lock and—"
"You wait one fucking minute,"
Shelton heard himself bark.
"I'm not done with you, Shanwei, dammit. I'm the officer of the day. And I'll tell you when I'm finished reaming you a new one."
He grabbed her shoulder to spin her back around to face him.
"I've had just about enough of you, you little bee—"
He staggered slightly as she turned back to face him. Actually, she twirled to face him, moving so quickly and gracefully he had no opportunity to jerk her around the way he'd intended. It was as if she'd started moving even before he touched her, and he stiffened his legs for balance and fastened his hand on her shoulder like a vice. She wouldn't feel his grip through her mail and arming tunic, but he took advantage of his stumble to throw his full weight onto her. Charles Shelton stood a fraction of an inch under 6 feet. That made him a veritable giant for Coruscant, with shoulders disproportionately wide even for his height. He'd never been intended for foot races, but he had excellent reflexes and worked out with a focused discipline that armored his naturally powerful frame with thick, supple muscle. He weighed well over 200 pounds, none of it fat, and Twerio, 8 inches shorter than he was, weighed perhaps half as much. The weight slamming down on her shoulders should have driven her to her knees, and that was exactly what he'd intended to do. He couldn't have said what he'd intended to do after she went down, but the real point was to demonstrate to her and to Princess Iris, that she had no business pretending to be a bodyguard when she couldn't even stay on her feet if someone stumbled into her. Unfortunately, she seemed unaware of his weight. She only gazed up at him, one eyebrow arched, sapphire eyes dark and contemptuous. Even through his fury, Shelton's brain warned him something was wrong. She hadn't simply held her footing. The straight, slim shoulder under his hand hadn't as much as dipped. He started to draw back, puzzled by her failure to collapse on schedule, but then he saw that arched eyebrow, realizing her calm expression hadn't even flickered. She was mocking him, refusing to so much as notice his effort to put her in her place.
"Listen, you little trollop," he snapped,
shaking her viciously, but remembering somehow to substitute trollop for the word he'd been about to use with Princess Iris standing 10 feet away.
"I'm not done, and you'll goddamn listen until I am. I don't give a solitary damn who sent you and who you think."
It dawned on him that he wasn't shaking her after all. He was shaking himself, because the shoulder under his hand had never budged, and all the force of his powerfully muscled arm had to go somewhere. "Take that hand off my shoulder or lose it." The coolness of her flat tone cut across his own bellicosity like a backhanded slap.
"What? What did you say to me?"
he demanded, unable to believe his ears.
"I've put up with everything I intend to tolerate from you, Lieutenant."
There was more than coolness in her tone now. There was ice, and his rank came out of her mouth like a curse, made all the more vicious by the contempt with which she uttered it.
"I'm your superior officer, whether or not I'm officially in your chain of command. You appear to have some difficulty grasping what that means. So, since you very kindly offered yourself for the position, I'm about to make an example out of you. Unless, of course, you'd care to take your hand off my shoulder, apologize to Her Highness for your language, and beg my pardon for behavior more appropriate in a drunken dockside pimp than an officer of the Coruscantian Royal Guard."
Shelton stared at her, unable even now to believe she dared to...
"Fine," she said. "Thank you for volunteering."
He blinked, and then she moved, and all he remembered for a very long time afterward was pain.
"All right, that had to hurt," Merlin Athrawes said thoughtfully. The Sajin reclined in an armchair in Caleb Armok's study, a stein of beer in his right hand and a plate of fried potato slices to his left, on the end table between his chair and Caleb's. The two of them were viewing the imagery Owl had captured of Charles Shelton's encounter with Nimu Chwerio. It had lasted barely 3 minutes, although it must have seemed far longer to Shelton. Aside from her interest in kendo, Nimu Alban had never been attracted to the martial arts. Merlin had acquired quite an impressive set of skills since then, relying in no small part on Apika's ability to program muscle memory, but Nimu Chwerio had gone quite a bit further. She'd plugged her high-speed connection into Owl and downloaded the moves for Moarte Subita, the martial art synthesized from half a dozen disciplines on the colony world Wallachia and later adopted by the Federation Marines. Then she'd spent several subjective 5 days in VR learning those moves and programming her own muscle memory. The result was impressive, and Merlin winced as he watched her scientifically dislocate the far larger Coruscantian's right shoulder. The left shoulder had already been dislocated, and he wasn't at all certain the arm connected to it hadn't been broken in the process. Shelton was also fortunate that Safeholdian dentists were capable of making very natural-looking false teeth. According to his current estimate, the lieutenant was going to need at least 6 of them, and Nimu wasn't finished yet. By the time she was, Shelton was barely conscious. He retained enough awareness when she finally stepped back, her expression as calm as when she'd begun, to try to crawl away from her, however. That showed better sense than anything else he'd done, although it was more probably some sort of primal survival instinct rather than the result of any reasoned process. "I'd say she was pissed off," Merlin observed as the imagery faded.
"You think?" Caleb shot back acidly.
"Well, she's a much younger and nicer person than I am. I doubt she'd have been quite that thorough if she hadn't been pissed off." Merlin took a thoughtful sip of beer. "I hope she would have been anyway. I don't remember having a disposition nasty enough to do that if I wasn't."
"This isn't really funny, you know, Merlin. She's there as my personal representative, and she just put the Royal Guard's third-ranking officer into the hospital with enough damage to keep him there for 5 days, and in front of witnesses, most of whom are experienced enough to realize she did it on purpose, and went right on doing it long after he'd have been more than willing to back off. My God, Merlin, she had him squealing like a little girl after 30 seconds."
"Like a little girl," Merlin repeated thoughtfully, as if sampling the word's taste while he selected a fresh potato slice from the plate. "Interesting you should pick that particular simile."
"Damn it, Merlin!"
Caleb's concern was obvious, even as he found it difficult not to laugh when Merlin rolled his eyes at him.
"This could have serious repercussions," the Emperor continued doggedly. "God only knows how the rest of the Guard will react."
"God may be the only one who knows, but I could hazard a pretty good guess about what's going to happen,"
Merlin offered around a mouthful of potato, and Caleb flopped back, waving both hands in a resigned go-ahead gesture.
"All right."
Merlin swallowed and cleared his throat, and his tone turned more serious. "You're right. There were witnesses, every one of whom saw Shelton put his hands on his superior officer first. And they know exactly who started the confrontation. People on the other side of Monchir probably heard what he was saying to her, Caleb. Some of those witnesses sure as hell did. I will guarantee you, and you know this from your own experience as well as I do, that not one guardsman worth a damn liked Shelton. They might have respected him before Nemu turned up and he started showing his ass, but she gave him plenty of time to straighten out, and gave them plenty of time to change their opinion of him when he didn't. She gave him 5 days to square himself away, and there's not a man in that unit who doesn't know Myers called Shelton in for that discussion because the idiot hadn't done anything of the sort. And what did Shelton do as soon as he finished talking to the Major? He went out and physically attacked someone half his own size. Did it in front of Iris." Merlin shook his head in pure disgust.
"They dote on her, Caleb. And they just got her and Diven back. Her husband barely survived an attack that killed 200 other people on her wedding day. Nemu is a Sajin sent for the express purpose of keeping her, Diven, and Hector alive. And this idiot is dim-witted enough to try to beat up that Sajin in front of her? I'm surprised someone that stupid remembers to breathe every so often."
Caleb frowned thoughtfully, and Merlin dipped another salted potato slice in the bowl of malt vinegar in the center of the platter and waved it like a pointer.
"By and large, those are damned good men, Caleb. They were even before Tobis and his boys got mustered in, and they're even better now. There isn't a one of them who's going to misunderstand the message Nemu just sent, or miss the fact that she demolished the son of a bitch without even ever touching a weapon, which she would have been perfectly justified in doing under their own regulations. If any of them, any of the rest of them, I mean, were inclined to pull that, 'I'm really a major and you're just a miserable little captain' crap with her, they sure as hell won't do it now. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they've gotten past the 'she's just a woman' stage where she's concerned, too. Probably did it before Shelton hit the ground. The first time he hit the ground, I mean. But they'd sure as hell manage it by the time he stopped squealing. More to the point, she won't need to break any more of them into little pieces to convince them they might just want to consider taking her advice in the future. Oh, and that they really, really don't want to piss her off." He shrugged. "I realize I may be a little prejudiced, but from where I sit,
This is what we used to call a win-win situation back on old Earth. He popped his potato slice pointer into his mouth, chewed appreciatively, and grinned. Want to watch it again with me in slow motion? Chapter 4 Claw Island, Sea of Harchong. The lookout's cry had barely faded, but the drums were already rolling as Lieutenant Henry Saltman dashed for the parapet with his breakfast napkin balled in his hand. Even as he ran, his brain insisted the lookout had to be wrong, had to be confused, or imagining things. There couldn't really be... He raced through the tropical dawn's coolness, past the furnaces designed to heat round-shot red-hot, up the steps of packed earth framed in logs, and reached the firing platform beside one of his long 25-pounders. The gun's crew stumbled up the steps on his heels. They were only half-dressed, still rubbing at sleep-crusted eyes, but Saltman heard the gun captain snapping out orders as they hurled themselves at the tackles. There were a total of 60 guns in the Dagger Point batteries, all under Saltman's command, and all along the embrasured earthen walls, other gun captains and crews dashed to clear for action. Every fourth gun was continuously manned, and the ready gun crews had already loaded with shell as per his standing orders. Now they stood beside their pieces, staring south across North Channel as Saltman skidded to a halt. The channel was 20 miles wide at this point, although enough shifting sandbanks came and went between Dagger Point and Hardship Shoal along its southern edge to convince any prudent captain to keep well clear, especially with the wind out of the north-northeast as it was this morning. And especially when he'd made his approach on one of the darkest nights of the year, without even a sliver of moon. Saltman swallowed hard as dawn light tinted the oncoming topsails rose and gold. Only one navy had enough confidence, enough audacity, to thread its way through Hog Island Passage and North Channel in total darkness. He didn't really need the standard flying from the intruder's masthead or the black hull with its bold white strake to tell him the Carisian Navy had come calling. Another ship followed two cables astern of the first, and still more topsails came into sight as the light strengthened mercilessly. They'd given themselves a generous spacing to avoid night collisions in confined waters, and he wondered how many more were coming along behind the ones he could already see.
"They're not supposed to be able to do this," he thought. "They're not supposed to be able to surprise us like this. What the hell happened?"
It was an unfair question, and he knew it. The Sea of Harchong was an enormous expanse of salt water, and the chance of a Carisian squadron evading the Dalaran cruisers who picketed the approaches to Claw Island itself had always been good. And while the island was the forward anchorage for Admiral Rosale's Western Squadron, the efficiency of anchored ships quickly deteriorated. Earl Thirsk believed in keeping the squadron at sea, actively patrolling the Harchong Narrows and making the sweeps and courtesy calls Mother Church expected of it along the coasts of Tygelkamp, Kiznetsov, and Queros. Everyone had realized the heretics were unlikely to mount any attacks on the island at a time chosen for the defenders' convenience. That was the reason it had been so heavily fortified after its recapture. But somehow the fact that this was precisely why his batteries had been put here didn't make Saltman feel any better as he watched those topsails glide slowly, gracefully across the shadowed water the rising sun had not yet quite touched.
"Langhorne, what is that thing?"
The question stabbed through his brain as sunlight did touch the leading galleon's hull, and he realized how enormous and peculiar-looking it was. It was easily 40 feet longer than any ship he'd ever seen, and unnaturally low in the water for its length. It also appeared to lack any of the spar deck carronades which were the hallmark of a Carisian warship. But who in his right mind built a ship that size and gave it only 30 guns?
He peered through his spyglass, still trying to wrap his mind around the galleon's presence, and realized it had no spar deck. The white strake along the gunports had tricked his eye into missing that initially because the bulwarks were so high they made the gunports seem too low for a vessel with only a single armed deck. Those solid, heavy-looking bulwarks had to be at least 6 or 7 feet high, and how was anyone supposed to see over that? It was ridiculous. But over the years, the Imperial Carisian Navy had done quite a few things other people considered ridiculous, until they faced Karis in battle and found out exactly why those ridiculous things had been done. He glanced over his shoulder to ensure that his standing orders had been followed. The signal for enemy in sight flew from the tall parade ground signal staff, and that was really all he could tell Admiral Kral until the rest of the oncoming galleons drew close enough to make some sort of count. By now, his own consternation must be flying around the entire circumference of Hardship Bay, rousing other battery commanders, warning them the long-anticipated and yet not really expected Carisian counterattack had finally arrived. He looked back to the lead galleon again and frowned as he realized how far north it was. Certainly any sensible captain would give Hardship Shoal and its sandbank necklace a generous clearance, but that same sensible captain must also know there had to be batteries on Dagger Point. Even within the confines of the safe channel, he could have stayed 6 or 7 miles from Saltman's guns, well beyond their effective range even with ricochet fire. The Dagger Point batteries were intended to prevent troop landings on the point, or in Dagger Inlet behind it, not to close North Channel. Oh, at low water and with unfavorable wind conditions, an attacker would be forced to come within their reach, but these people were arriving on the heels of the flood, with ample water depth and a wind which was almost perfect for their purposes. So why was that galleon shaping its course to pass within less than 2 miles of the point?
They'll probably change course any minute now. With only the topsails set, they'd take 90 minutes to enter our range, even on that heading. There's plenty of time to change their minds. And in the meantime... Get those furnaces hot! He barked.
I really wish the Admiral had been a little reasonable about this, sir, Lieutenant Divan Kilmon said quietly as he and Captain Sir Brustir Abbott stood on HMS Thunderer's afterdeck.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Divan, Abbott replied, looking up at his much taller First Lieutenant.
All Chisomians seemed unreasonably tall to Abbott, an Emeraldian only an inch or so taller than Prince Narman had been.
It seemed to me that his orders couldn't have been more clearly and rationally set forth. Was there some point you wanted me to explain?
That's not what I meant, sir, Kilmon said just a bit severely.
Abbott was 16 years older than the lieutenant, yet Kilmon sometimes felt like a tutor with a rambunctious charge. He'd developed enormous respect for the small captain's ability, and Admiral Rockpoint hadn't chosen the skippers for the ICN's first ocean-going ironclads by throwing darts at the wall, but Abbott's notion of humor could be a bit trying. In fact, he was prone to practical jokes, and although he was careful to avoid anything that might hamper the ship's efficiency or damage his officer's authority, he tended to come up with them at the damnedest moments. That and his penchant for suddenly and randomly choosing officers or petty officers to become fatalities during drills, or for pulling out his watch in the middle of a calm afternoon, studying it for a moment, and then deciding the ship had just lost her topmasts to a sudden squall that required all hands to turn to and sway up fresh spars to keep her afloat, had certainly kept his first lieutenant on his toes throughout the month-long voyage from Port Royal. It did the same thing for the rest of the ship's company, of course, and that was a good thing. But Kilmon did sometimes wish his lively captain would at least warn him about his intentions.
What I meant, sir, the lieutenant continued in an "and you knew very well what I meant" tone of voice,
is that I'd really rather not find out we were wrong about how effective our armor is by getting the Admiral killed in the opening engagement. He should have let us take the lead.
I can't say I disagree,
Abbott admitted in a rather more serious tone.
But do you actually think there was ever any chance of that happening?
Of course not, Kilmon sighed. Doesn't keep me from wishing, though.
Well, they probably don't have anything nearly as heavy as the guns Captain Roswell used to test our armor.
So, unless something untoward happens, Dreadnought should make out just fine.
Excuse me, sir, but aren't you the one who keeps saying we ought to always expect the unexpected to present itself at the least convenient moment possible?
A truly dutiful First Officer wouldn't have brought that up, Master Kilmon. He'd simply have nodded and said, "Of course, sir."
Of course, sir. Forgive me. How could I have forgotten?
Very proper of you. Abbott approved and raised his double glass to gaze at the gun-studded wall of earth looming up out of the morning shadows.
I estimate we'll enter their range in about 15 minutes, my lord,
Captain Carlton Heigl said.
Thank you, Carlton,
Earl Sharpfield replied just as gravely. Heigl looked at him a moment, then drew a curiously resigned breath and returned his attention to his helmsman. Sharpfield smiled at his flag captain's back. Heigl was a fellow Chisomian, a weathered-looking sort with iron-gray hair and very dark eyes who'd commanded HMS Arrow at the Battle of Darko Sound. Arrow had been one of the rearmost galleys in Sharpfield's western column, closest to the Carizians. She'd been sunk early in the fight, and Heigl, who wore a patch over the empty socket of the left eye he'd lost that day, had found the transition from galley command to galleon command difficult afterward. Indeed, it would have been fair to call him a merely adequate ship handler even now, and some people wondered why Sharpfield had lobbied High Admiral Rockpoint to name a man with that record to command HMS Dreadnought for him. But that was because they didn't know Heigl the way Sharpfield did, or the way Rockpoint had come to know him after Darko Sound. There might be a great many better seamen in the ICN, but there wasn't a more fearless man on the face of the world, and Carlton Heigl's determination would put a bulldog to shame. In a fleet taken completely by surprise, faced by a sledgehammer of firepower no captain had ever imagined might be possible, half-blinded in the very first broadside, still he'd fought his ship until she literally foundered under him, ripped apart by cannon fire, and dyed scarlet with the blood of her crew. And as Arrow went to the bottom, he'd seen to it that every one of her wounded, of her other wounded, was safely aboard one of his surviving boats or improvised rafts before he'd stepped over the rail into the sea himself. In fact, he was very like a close friend he'd made following the Battle of Darko Sound, a man named Gwilym Monthyr. There'd never been any question in Sharpfield's mind who he'd wanted to command his flagship, and Rockpoint had agreed. But for all his personal courage, Heigl was clearly nervous about deliberately sailing into the fire of a well-dug-in battery of heavy guns, firing shells and heated shot with his admiral on deck. He'd suggested more than once, in what he'd obviously thought was tactful fashion, that Sharpfield should go below, behind Dreadnought's thickest armor, before action was joined.
"I think you're making the captain anxious, my lord," a voice observed, and Sharpfield glanced at the dark-haired, dark-eyed flag lieutenant at his elbow. Sir Marak Templeton was hard-working, conscientious, and very fond of the flag captain, and he shook his head at his admiral. "I know there's not much you can do about it, but I do sympathize with him."
"I suppose I do, too. It is a bit humorous to see one of the few genuine men of iron I know fretting about it, though."
"It'll be a lot less humorous if you manage to get yourself killed or wounded, my lord. If that happens, I promise to live long enough to dictate my revised will to you, Marak."
Templeton snorted. Despite his many sterling qualifications as a flag lieutenant, he did have one drawback. His handwriting was
execrable, at best. "Excuse me, my lord. Now that you've warned me, I'll just go fetch Franz, shall I?" he said, and it was Sharpfield's turn to snort. Franz Heilmann, his personal secretary and clerk, had the elegant penmanship found in the finest scriptoriums. Even his shorthand looked graceful and flowing.
"You see, Marak, it's that sort of forethought that got you elevated to flag lieutenant," the Earl said. "Do your best to be sure some rude Dalaran gunner doesn't remove the head you used to produce it."
Henry Saltman raised his spyglass again while he tried to understand what could possibly be going through the oncoming galleon captain's mind. His present course would bring his ship to within 200 yards or so of the ship channel's northern edge. He'd be less than 800 yards from the main battery at that point, and that was killing range. The Carisian captain had to see the furnace smoke, and surely he must realize Claw Island would have been provided with the new exploding shells. So what in Shanwei's name could he think he was doing?
"Open fire, sir."
He lowered his glass and looked at Lieutenant Lambert, his second in command. Lambert's voice was level, but there was more than a trace of anxiety in his eyes, although Saltman could hardly blame him for that.
"Not just yet, Leonard. If he's willing to come still closer, that's just fine with me."
Saltman showed his teeth in a brief, tight smile.
"We're the ones with all these nice earthworks. I think we can afford to let him have the first broadside."
"Yes, sir."
Lambert saluted and moved down the parapet towards his own station, and Saltman concentrated on the galleon again. It looked as if the Carisian was actually prepared to anchor by the stern with a spring on the cable, and that was the most foolhardy thing he'd done yet. At the very least, he should keep moving, try to make himself a bit harder to hit. If he really meant to anchor right in the play of Saltman's waiting guns... Wait. What was that? The day was much warmer, moving towards its usual scorching heat, with the sun fully above the horizon, and the lieutenant frowned as sunlight reflected from the water to pick out details of the hull he hadn't seen yet, including the way the ship's paint had been scoured by winter seas on her passage from Chisholm. That was scarcely unexpected, given the storms that stalk Carter's Ocean and the Sea of Harchong in winter. But there were streaks of something where the paint had been stripped away. Something reddish, duller than the usual primer coats. Something that looked almost like rust.
"Oh, sweet Langhorne,"
he thought, around a sudden icy lump of dread. Before his transfer to Claw Island, he'd served with the main fleet out of Gorath Bay. He'd seen the first of Lieutenant Zweiger's screw galleys and been impressed by their speed and maneuverability, at least in short bursts in coastal waters. And he remembered their bow-mounted heavy artillery and the iron plates affixed to their forward hulls to protect their guns. Iron plates, which tended to corrode under the kiss of salt water and streak the ship's sides with rust.
"Signal to Admiral Kral and Captain Lewiston,"
he heard himself bark.
"Yes, sir."
A startled signal midshipman snatched for his pencil and pad. Saltman made himself pause until the youngster was ready, then cleared his throat.
"Signal enemy warships in North Channel appear to be armored. You'll have to spell that last word. Then send engaging, and get it off quickly."
"Well, I see they're awake over there after all," Sharpfield remarked as the nearest battery erupted in thunder.
No more than 35 or 40 of Dagger Point's total guns would bear on Dreadnought at the moment, and he had no intention of allowing his flagship to stray into the play of any additional guns until he demonstrated her immunity to his own satisfaction. And, of course, whatever might be true of her hull, her masts and spars were no better armored than any other galleons.
Fortunately, with the wind out of the north-northeast, she'd drift away from the batteries if she was dismasted, and there was plenty of distance between Dragon Point and Hardship Shoal for her to anchor and make repairs. It was very quiet on the flagship's deck, the quiet of disciplined men waiting for the orders they knew must come. That stillness, that calm before the storm, was all the more striking against the background bellow of the Dolaran artillery. And then,
"Stand by to anchor!"
They were anchoring, Saltman realized. His ears cringed under the roar of the guns, and he coughed on the choking fog of powder smoke. Gun captains were shouting commands, swabs darted down smoke-steaming bores, and he raised the spyglass once more, waiting for the banks of smoke to clear. Over half the Dolaran gun crews managed to miss their target, which, Sharpfield reflected, actually wasn't bad shooting for the first rounds fired out of smoothbore guns at the next best thing to half a mile. White spouts pocked the surface, other shells went skipping and bounding across the water, ricocheting like thrown stones, or flew past to land far beyond Dreadnought as the ironclad stern anchor plunged into the water. Topmen scurried aloft, taking in her topsails, and men leaned into the tween-deck's capstan bars as they took tension on the spring and rotated the ship to train her broadside on the battery. Not all the gunners missed, however, and everyone heard the hammered anvil clangor as a dozen 25-pounder shells scored direct hits. Some of them broke up on impact. The others bounced off the 3-inch Hausmannized steel plate like baseballs off a backstop. Sharpfield felt the vibration, heard the ringing sledgehammer blows, and smiled coldly as he peered through a broadside angle glass, waiting. The smoke rolled downwind, and Henry Saltman's stomach tightened as that ominous black hull emerged into the light once more. There wasn't a mark on it.
"They can't all have missed," he thought. "I know some of those shells were direct hits. They had to be, but..."
HMS Dreadnought vanished behind a flame-colored, sulfur-reeking cloud. 15 6-inch guns fired as one, and unlike the Dolaran gunners ashore, none of them missed. True, the battery was a much larger target, and Dreadnought's guns were rifled, but it was still a striking contrast in accuracy. The difference in effect was even more striking. Lieutenant Saltman watched the Carisian galleon disappear into its own dark brown gun smoke. The incoming shells made a strange, warbling sound that ended abruptly as they slammed into his parapet. Then they exploded. He staggered, eyes wide, shocked by their sheer power. His own guns fired 25-pound round shot, but their hollow-cored shells weighed 40% less, and their bursting charges weighed only a pound and a half. The diameter of the incoming Carisian shells was only about 10% greater, but they were much longer, their muzzle velocity was almost 20% higher, and they were 5 times as heavy. They struck with over 7 times the impact energy and carried 10 times the bursting charge. Their elongated shape and ogival nose were much more ballistically efficient, their higher striking power drove them deep into their target, and the explosions were devastating. Anemic compared to what might have been accomplished with a high-explosive nitrocellulose bursting charge, perhaps, but devastating enough. Earl Sharpfield waited impatiently for the brown powder's dense smoke to clear the range. He'd been aboard Dreadnought when Captain Heigl's gun crews trained against sample earthworks built especially to provide appropriate targets. He'd seen what her shells could do then, but there was a difference between observing the damage to an inoffensive wall of dirt built solely as a training target and the damage wreaked upon a hostile battery's entrenchments, weapons, and men. The smoke rolled aside, and Sharpfield's lips drew back in a hunting-slash-lizard smile as he saw the earthwork's cratered face.
The bastards didn't pile the dirt deep enough, he thought. They'd stand up to 30-pounder round shot all day long, but not to this.
Not even the heavy shells would demolish the defensive works as quickly as he might wish, but they'd do the job one hell of a lot more quickly than the Dalarans would have believed possible. And they didn't have to tear down the entire earthwork to silence the battery. One of the embrasures had taken a direct hit. It had to be a fluke. No one could deliberately target a single gun at 800 yards with his very first shot, no matter how good he was. But that made it no less effective. That particular 25-pounder wouldn't be firing again, and as he swept the angle glass along the breadth of the enemy parapet, he could almost feel the defender's morale wavering. The Dalaran guns fired again, concealing themselves behind their own paler powder smoke, and Dreadnought rang like an enormous bell. But the shells bounced off yet again, and her gun crews bayed like hungry wolves. They bent back to their guns vengefully, and beyond them, moving majestically down the buoyed channel, HMS Thunderer led HMS Tumult and Turmoil into the heart of Hardship Bay. They were followed by 31 more galleons of the Imperial Carisian Navy, by transports loaded with 8,000 Imperial Marines, and by a long line of colliers filled to the deckheads with Chisholm's best anthracite. Sharpfield turned his back on the smoke-shrouded battery, watching those topsails sweep past his anchored flagship, and wondered if the rest of Claw Island's garrison would grasp the message Dreadnought was in the process of delivering. He hoped they would. Or perhaps he didn't. There'd been no real need for his flagship to engage the Dragon Point batteries. She could have passed them without ever entering their range, as her consorts were doing at this very moment. She was here engaging the defenses, ripping them apart, and effortlessly shrugging off the worst they could do for only one reason. To prove she could.
Pay attention, you bastards, the Earl thought, turning back to the angle glass, peering at the earthen walls as Dreadnought flayed them with fists of fire. Pay attention, damn you. Learn the lesson now, or learn it later. Because there's not one damned thing you can do to stop me from taking this island back. The only thing you get to decide is how frigging many of you we kill before you get smart enough to surrender. And just at the moment, I'm sort of hoping you turn out to be slow learners after all.